Linji, the man who first told the story that I'm going to reflect on this morning, he was not a nice man. This 9th century Buddhist master founded the Linji school of Chan Buddhism, and he is said to have whacked his students with a fly swatter. And if internet image researches are to be trusted, there appears to be not a single sculpture or engraving or image of him ever made in which he is not scowling like the much-discussed Mama Grizzly protecting her cubs. And today, I give you this scowling sage's most famous story. Like Linji, this story is not nice. It is, in fact, something quite different than nice, and perhaps very much more important. It is a story that makes no sense. A story that knocks us out of our comfort zones, that invites us to consider something different than whatever chicken soup for the soul populated the cultural equivalent of Oprah's book club in ancient China. It is a challenge. It is a goading drama that is intentionally shocking. And here is what Linji said to his students when they came to him asking how they might become enlightened. Followers of the way, if you want to get the kind of understanding that accords with the Dharma, never be misled by others. Whether you're facing inward or you are facing outward, whatever you meet up with, just kill it. If you meet a Buddha, kill the Buddha. If you meet a patriarch, kill the patriarch. If you meet an enlightened one, kill the enlightened one. If you meet your parents, kill your parents. If you meet your kinfolk, kill your kinfolk. Then, for the first time, you will gain emancipation. You will not be entangled with things. You will pass freely wherever you must go. It's not a nice story. If you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. That's the phrase that has been passed on generation after generation from one befuddled yet oddly enchanted storyteller to another. If you meet the Blessed One, do anything in your power to strike her down and keep on moving. This, my friends, is a fine example of a story that makes no sense. And that is why I love it. Stories that make no sense, this is, for some reason, the running theme of our multi-part sermon series this year. These are stories that do not follow the cultural conventions of their time or any time. These are stories that leave us scratching our heads, wondering out loud what the heck the point is, and if it's a point we really want to buy into in the first place. We spoke first in this series some months ago about one of Jesus' parables, and today we grapple with this second parable, told by another great spiritual leader, the scowling sage, Linji. These two men, Jesus and Linji, disconnected by centuries, representing vastly different cultural and religious traditions, nonetheless spoke their stories with a similar intentionality. From what one can discern from their stories, neither of these two teachers, Jesus or Linji, had anything as mundane as the comfort of their listeners in mind when they taught. What they had was something different, perhaps something greater. What they hoped for was the utter transformation of the people who came to them seeking wisdom. Utter transformation. Not comfort in the night, not bolstering their self-confidence, not spiritual deepening or even peaceful rest or correct answers, but utter transformation that calls into question all the certainties and makes room in their stead for something unimaginably new. With their stories, these two teachers endeavored to break down all the images and the icons and the accepted mores of their times. They tried to turn everything that was certain upside down and begin to build a new world of thought from the crumbly little bits of the old. They were, in a word, iconoclasts. Isn't that a marvelous word, iconoclasts? Iconoclast is the word that's most often associated with Lin Ji by cultural Western critics who talk about him. He was the iconoclast of his age, and I would argue that Jesus was similarly the greatest iconoclast of his age, and that we, perhaps above all others, are a religious tradition that ought to value the wisdom of the iconoclast. That word, iconoclast, the one who destroys idols. The one who tears down graven images. The one who challenges orthodoxy and decries all self-righteous forms of outward piety in favor of inward transformation. You may even think of yourself as an iconoclast. Or perhaps you admire iconoclasts from afar, wishing you were that courageous. I personally do not think I actually have the courage to be an iconoclast, but these men did. And even if I could never be them, I can bear some inspiring from them. Lin Ji, you see, didn't even bother to bow to the time-honored conviction that a guy ought to be nice. To his mind, even that outward form of good behavior was an impediment to the truth. Even being well-behaved was a sign of your cowing to the patterns and orthodoxies of your day. And even the Buddha himself was knocked down from his pedestal because reverence for even such a wise one as that could be twisted into lazy submission rather than followed toward real transformation. Lin Ji's students came to him asking, "How do I get enlightenment? How do I get the job done? What rule do I follow? And will you, my teacher, get me there?" Those questions then and now are often asked with an implicit assumption that enlightenment has a recipe which, if handed down from generation to generation and followed in just the right measure, might manage all the hard work for you. It is as if salvation were a cupcake. And all you need to whip it up rightly is the white flour of sanctity, the pure sugar of charity, and the living leavening of prayer. Different leaders and different traditions might offer you different combinations of ingredients. The way may be laid out before you in 1,000 clear-cut steps, and you may well choose to follow those steps as a part of your path. But Lin Ji knew that the recipe itself is not enough to feed you when you are hungry. And the steps, no matter how carefully you follow them, will not fill the soul that yearns for truth. The truth that Lin Ji knew, and that I believe Jesus knew, is that there is no one single way forward, and in the place of absolute answers, we must ask our wisest teachers simply to hold us accountable so that we might remain willing to be changed and to change others. The way forward, salvation, enlightenment, these things do not come when we follow the rules. They come when we dare to question the rules. And then in time, come back again on the other side of all of our rebellion to a place of peaceful willingness. A place where we are willing and able to make a wise and compassionate choice, not because we're supposed to, but because we can. We are in many ways iconoclasts. And the great religious iconoclasts, with all their stories that made no sense, with all their sayings that challenged everything familiar, they stood up to the idol worshippers of their times. Now, idolatry is a sort of arcane concept for us. Idolatry, the worship of idols. It could be defined roughly as the uplifting of finite objects or limited things to the level of loyalty and trust that is intended for the ultimate. It's making a god out of something lesser than a god. It's raising up temporal things to the level of the Almighty. It's pretending that any teacher, no matter how wise, can give you the recipe for life, and that any one way is the way for all time. Now, somewhere deep within the DNA of the monotheistic traditions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, there has long rested a real dis-ease with the tangible imaging, with making a picture of God. the whole idea of drawing a picture of the divine that probably will look a lot like the person drawing it has long made people uncomfortable. And as the poet Rilke said, "We must not portray you in king's robes, you drifting mist that brought forth the morning. We must not portray you in king's robes or our clothes, you drifting mist, you ultimate mystery that brought forth the morning. We must not take the mystery, the ultimate holy mystery, and wrap it up in images that look suspiciously like ourselves, nor may we take the truth, the complex and glorious truth of our existence, containing as it does both darkness and light, and pretend that it's contained in one single phrase, or picture, or teaching, which can be handed down from master to student without struggle, or even sometimes the bitter taste of tears." Linji, representing the Buddhist tradition, did not have to challenge images of the Godhead, because in his tradition there is no separate, independent spirit called God. But there were and are images of the Buddha. There were and are those among his followers who mistook the teacher's wisdom for the end of the road rather than the beginning. And what he saw among those eager students who came to him begging for answers was nothing less than another form of idolatry, elevating the teacher on a level higher than the journey itself. It was an idolatry that this man would not stand for. And so he called it out, and he said what others wouldn't. In saying that one should kill the Buddha on the road, he stated that not even the beloved teacher could take the place of an earnest and difficult journey. Not even the ones you love the most, not your parents, your children, your friends, have the answers for you. Not even the ones you aspire to be have the answers for you. Not anyone. Not the seemingly enlightened guy in the next cubicle who never seems to break a sweat and has all those precious pictures of perfect children lined up on his desk. Not even that guy has the answers for you. Nobody. But there is a journey that stretches out before you. And with courage, with the commitment to break free from the bonds of all that came before, it's a journey that you can undertake for yourself. And so the cranky teacher tells his students that if on your journey you should ever meet an enlightened one, you should kill him and move on. And if you ever meet the holiest teacher of all, the Buddha himself, leave him dead on the road and walk toward the distant horizon, because he does not have the answer for you. Pretending he does is only an impediment to the ultimate truth that this is a journey you must take, that these are decisions you must make, that nobody can hand you the recipe. Now, one might imagine that in preaching in front of this gang about iconoclasts and breaking expected patterns and not implicitly respecting the wisdom of teachers, you might imagine that I am preaching to the choir. Unitarian Universalists, after all, pride ourselves on a long history of iconoclasm, and I have no delusion that you all believe everything I say. But the fact is that even among iconoclasts, there can be idolatry. Even among those who reject what most consider religious and traditional practices of piety, there is a tendency to raise up lesser things to the level of ultimate concern. Honestly, these days I see all kind of idolatry in the political process. A tendency among people of all sides to believe that if and when their party rises to ascendancy, everything's going to be fine again. In and around the 2008 election, many held what I would call an idolatrous image of our president, really believing that, like the Buddha, he might give us the recipe and guide us all home again. In the wake of Tuesday's elections, those on one side mourn the seeming loss of the way forward. Those on the other celebrate as if here, with an election that turns things from blue to red, all our problems are at an end. But no political leader, no party, no color, no piece of legislation is the end, and nobody, not even the best leaders the world will ever know, can solve our problems and hand us the truth in the form of a political platform. If you see the party that claims to own the truth, walk away and greet the horizon. In this age, I do not worry about golden calves, about the building of monuments to the representative gods of the ages, but I do worry still about idolatry. I worry that we do harm to one another only to keep faith with finite things like power and hegemony and the flow of global economic tides. I worry about the uplifting of gods who do not speak for us, do not represent us, and do not make us more whole. We should have teachers. We should have reverence before the holy ones. We should always sit at the feet of someone who has gifts to offer us. But to have a teacher, is not to raise that person to the level of an idol. We always need loved ones who point us forward, who help shape our paths, but the lesson Linji tells us in the story that makes no sense is that every teacher, every practice, every tradition can offer only a beginning of the journey and never its culmination. Enlightenment cannot be purchased from an infomercial. Wisdom is not handed down in a series of easy-to-follow steps, and God does not care when you bow and if you cross yourself with the right hand and how each grain of sand lies in the garden of the Buddha. God does not care if you do it right, because neither God nor the enlightened ones among us ever did appoint one right way to do it. In the words of Soko Morinaga, who had our reading this morning, enlightenment itself is not even the end, but just the beginning. Every wisdom we may encounter, every teacher and every sage, is just the start. Morinaga says, enlightenment is liberation from the dross of learning and experience that, without one's being aware of it, has accumulated and settled with so much, like so much sediment on our shoulders, or like the cholesterol in one's arteries. Enlightenment is the vivid, lively manifestation of the heart with which one is born, the heart that has no form, no mind, no abiding attachment, neither to form or thought, but in dynamic motion. Consequently, enlightenment is not an end point, but rather a starting point. And so let us be born again every moment, especially when we encounter great wisdom. May it be so, and amen.